mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world, then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags-to-riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires, many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guest, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this. If you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you. All right, welcome today to Ditch Digger CEO. I'm excited. We got Ryan sitting on with us here, and he's a great founder, CEO of a nice company in Texas. We're gonna hear about his story. Ryan, we're happy to have you on board today. We're excited to hear your story. You're gonna tell it like it is, and we're gonna listen and ask a lot of good questions. Hopefully we get you scratching your head a little bit and maybe even confused with some of our questions.
I look forward to it. That rarely happens. So if you can get me stumped, man, that'd be interesting.
Awesome. So Ryan, we always like to hear about, you know, the whole story, kind of, you know, where you grew up, your the values you were raised on, and you know, if there's faith in your family, great family, and faith is part of a lot of our stories. So a little bit of that's great. And then kind of where you came up with the idea to start in business, and what's going on in your head today and the future.
Wow, Gary, that is a big opening question. I normally give about an hour-long speech just about all that stuff, but I'll try to keep it brief so we can have some conversation. You know, I'll start off with a bit of the story. Since you mentioned family values, I'm gonna tell you something that almost never comes up in these type of podcasts. When I was conceived, my parents were not married. In fact, my parents were coming out of marriages to other people. And I was born January 11th, 1975. When my mom got pregnant with me, their plan was to have me aborted. And literally, I think it was like a Friday. She was going to go in and have the procedure on a Monday. On that Friday, she calls up my mom's name is Betty. She calls up Jim and says, "Hey, I can't do it. I can't have an abortion." She was devout Catholic. And he says, "All right, what do you want to do?" He says, "Well, I'm going to have this baby." He says, "All right, I guess we'll get married." And they got married, had me, had two other kids, and were married the rest of their lives. My dad is still alive. My mom passed away 2 years ago. And so they were married for 47 years. I was literally days away from being aborted. And
you must be a fan of life then.
It's funny, people ask me, because it's not a secret. I was a conservative Republican in Texas. And when people ask me about my stance on abortion, I just tell that story. It's fascinating now to reflect, to be like, man, to be that close. Now, why I tell that story is, you think about, I do get sometimes questions, like employees will come out. This is a real story from Pinnacle one time. I was in one morning, and I'm grabbing a cup of coffee, and I'm about to walk into a meeting, and there's a woman that worked for us at the time, and she was in the break room. She's kind of crying, and I could tell you, teary-eyed, and I said, what's fun? And I know her real well, but well enough to ask, and we were pretty good size. And she's kind of emotional, and I said, we stepped into the conference room for a second. What's going on? She goes, "Man, Ryan, I mean, tears, and everything. I'm pregnant." And I said, "Okay, I take it from your reaction, this is not good news." And she says, "No. In fact, I got pregnant with a guy. We were just on a few dates, and we didn't even know if there was a future. And now I'm pregnant. I don't know what to do." And I'm talking about it. She says, at one point, I'm not kidding, the line was something like, "I mean, Ryan, here comes this baby coming into the world." And she already decided, I think, "Yeah, I'm going to have this baby," but born totally out of wedlock. You know, no future, no plan. I got no college fund. I got no nothing. "Ryan, what kind of future does a child like this have?" I'm not kidding. That was her line. And I said, "Well, you're talking to one." And you said, "There's such a, you don't get those moments, right? Without these great stories."
That's awesome that you can share that with people, because there's a lot of, in my opinion, your story can change the hearts of many and save the lives of many. And boy, that's pretty cool that they'll share that.
I when I ran for governor, I told stories that that I'd been around in my life, right? That made me a strong pro-life person as well. But you got to tell those stories, because otherwise people don't get it.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'll say, that look, fast forward, and so I grew up in Dallas area. Mom and dad both teachers. Didn't have a lot of extra money, but we were a very, man, talk about a can-do household. Never saw a repairman come to the house. Dad was just the smartest guy you've ever met. Put himself through college. So did mom, both the first in their generation to college. I was actually the first in the next generation in both families to go to college, even though, well, my mom's a huge family. But if you were to say, well, Ryan, you know, what things led to you being successful later in life? It was both parents instilled in me this idea that your only limitation is your own drama. And that was as young as I mean, literally before birth, right? And mom and dad were like, well, we don't know how we're going to do this.
Your only limitation is your own what?
Is your own drive. You are your only limitation. They wouldn't tolerate growing up, oh, this teacher doesn't like me, or this thing is not fair. Guess what, son? The world's not fair, right? The world is what you make of it. And that is hard, I think, for a lot of people to get these days in the world around us. There's so much status in social media and in the press and all these other places that it can be hard to believe. But man, I fast forward all the way to today, sitting here running a $100 million business that I am with a lot of blessings, no question. But it was that belief in myself that my parents gave me that was invaluable.
Awesome. That's awesome. And that's a great start, because that's what we talk about this every time around, right? The ambition that we have as entrepreneurs, it's got to be one that gets through tough times. It's got to be one that realizes aspiration and never envy. And again, reading up a little bit about your story, I can tell you got a lot of that in you. Tell me how it kind of started. Did you come out of college and jump in this industry, or what happened?
Yeah, in fact, all right. So go to A&M, Texas A&M, get a mechanical engineering degree. Had no idea what I wanted to do, but A&M tends to send a lot of its engineers into industry. So oil and gas, chemicals, manufacturing. And I ended up at a chemical company. And once again, no dream to do this. It was just a good job, paid well. My wife and I were getting married right out of college. And she also is a mechanical engineer. So we kind of came to the same area, started working in plants. And over the next 5 years, realized, man, there is a real need in these plants to develop better systems for how they do maintenance and inspection. And there were good experts in place, but it wasn't very systematic. It was very people dependent, as opposed to standards and processes and analytics. So rewind to 2006, when I started Pinnacle, there's a fun anecdote about how I really, what really kind of pushed me over the edge to start it. But when I started it, it was, man, there is so much data. This is all the way back to 2006. So much data being generated from inspections and vibration and data about all this equipment. And we're not pulling it together and analyzing it very well. So back then, no one used the term data analytics or data science, because that wasn't sexy. In fact, if I had told somebody that's what we were doing, they would have laughed at me like I was some dork without a real business. But we were doing that back, 17 years ago, and started building these systems for literally the largest companies on earth to track the most valuable assets on earth. I say that because you take a big refinery in, say, South Texas, it's worth like $50 billion. And so how do you maintain it and operate it and make sure it's safe and reliable? That's really what our company does. And so when you asked me, how do we get into this, sort of by accident, and then, found my way into this niche by working around the plants for a few years. And then,
Okay. So it's funny you mentioned this, because we one of our paving businesses, we've always differentiated by basically figuring out the best engineering in the world, best processes we could find in the world, and then applying them to the jobs you do for our customers, paving big parking lots, okay? Originally just asphalt paving, eventually concrete paving. But about 15 years ago, we found out about a design of a concrete pavement that could last hundreds of years based on Roman technology, right? Roman engineering. So sure enough, we dove into it, hook, line, and sinker. I bought the most expensive equipment you can buy to put this concrete down and everything else. And it's a great product. Every job we've done looks like it did the day we put it down 15 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever. But the problem with this pavement is it sets up so fast. It's paved really dry. And so the finish of the concrete was not as pretty, as good looking as a normal conventional finished concrete pavement or finished asphalt pavement. So, I mean, I for the last 15 years, I've been beating my head against the wall saying, we got to figure out how to finish this to be like regular concrete. It'll dominate the industry. Well, a couple different people did figure that out over the last few years. We hired one of these people, a young man out of Texas who worked for a big company there, and that had a division that did RCC, roller compacted concrete. This young man now has come to work for us. We're starting a whole national company. It's going to be called RCC, but Rabine compacted concrete. And what first thing he said to me when I had lunch with him, spent the day with him a couple of days ago, is he goes, gosh, he goes, I'm really getting into these big chemical plants that we're working at. They love RCC because they don't want to ever have to do, you know, repave it. They don't want to have to maintain it. And he goes, we're the perfect product. So he goes, so it's kind of funny. You started with that because I didn't really think that was big of a market. But he's saying, Gary, I'm telling you, I've been doing so much work at these plants because they want you in and out. They don't want you ever back again if they can help it. And they'll pay a little extra for that, right? So
oh, yeah.
It's funny you mentioned that. But very similarly though, Ryan, you know, we grew our businesses nationally by serving the biggest real estate holding companies in the country and giving them differentiating service they couldn't get anywhere else. And one thing I did was not being an engineer. I mean, I just barely graduated high school, but I liked engineering, right? And civil specifically. I like building stuff. But I started hiring civil engineers and engineers, you know, 25 years ago. And eventually I started reaching to figure out who the best engineers in the world were in my space, and found those engineers, some in America, not too many, mostly Germany, Israel, and some other places. That I started using their engineering and giving that engineering away to my customers nationally, because I believe the products would last longer and all that. And that was the beginning of our national success. And then since then, what you're getting into, I want to hear more of this. We've been using artificial intelligence and drones and a lot of cool things to shrink the amount of time with boots on the ground that our competition and myself have been using forever, right? So, you know, kind of similar, we're leading and serving our facilities customers. That's our niche. And actually, energy for us is the gas industry and the electric industry, big electrical utility companies and gas companies are some of our bigger customers. So it sounds like we share some similar space.
It is.
So tell me what you did. Tell me what you did to get into and stay in with these companies and grow your business. What'd you do to differentiate yourself? Because I'm sure there are a lot of competitors that have been doing it forever. And then here you are, this young punk coming on the scene, right? What'd you do to stay there with, stay as a preferred vendor?
It is it's something you mentioned. In fact, I'll say this for all your listeners out there. It's so easy to feel like, man, it's hard to break in, especially to big business. If I want to do B2B work and I want to serve a large corporation, that is hard. And there's always a lot of demand. Everyone wants to do business with Exxon, right? Because they got massive amounts of money. The two things I would say that that set us apart. One, we have always and we continue to have a better solution. So there is the way that people always want to do things. We've got to always be adding something to that. And even in areas that I could tell a bit of our story, we started the company in 2006, grew like crazy until 2020. 2019, 2020, 2019 is actually our best year. And then 2020, 2021, and 2022 were all down years. Now 2023 is a growth year again. So we had our first ever slump after being in business 14 years. And if I look back, I'd say we got to the point where we're getting fat and happy. Man, we are the best in the world at doing this. We can do this better than everybody. We're doing this at scale. Fact is, if you do it the same way it doesn't take long for people to catch up. And so one is we're always innovating, always figuring out a way to do something better, add value. And that is easy to lose. In fact, I would say that one thing I see most entrepreneurial companies where they start to falter is when the original founder's energy and entrepreneurial drive to come up with something better, when that begins to slump. So that's one. Two is, as simple as it sounds, I'm going to say this too simply because it's just cliche, to look out for your customer first. Now that's cliche. If someone says that to me, I dismiss it. What does that really mean? Here's what it is. A lot of people buy a lot of things, especially in big business, without really understanding the value of this thing. I can't tell you how often in big business, I mean, it could be transportation, banking, healthcare. People buy stuff all the time because it was on their buy sheet. But we go out and say, let's make sure we're always creating value for our customers. So I'm going to do something better than it's ever been done. I'm going to make sure when I do it, they spend a dollar on me, they're getting $2 of value. And the service that goes along with that, the commitment to taking care of that customer, as simple as those two things sound, you'd be surprised. It's very hard to find a company that really focuses on those two because it's just so easy. It's like, now we've got a nice sized company. We're making a little bit of profit. We're doing some work. They like us, right? Especially in a small business, you know, when you got 20, 30 employees, you get to our size, we're 500 a day. I expect by the end of next year, we'll be probably, you know, you're probably 100 bigger than that. And you got to have systematic ways to make sure we're always offering something better to the marketplace and always make sure we're creating value for our customers in ways that they can understand. That I'd say almost any business, you do those two things, you will be a leg up over your competition because most companies don't do that.
I love it. I love it. And again, you know, maybe you got a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason because it works. If you sincerely look out for your customer first, you know, over profits, over your own sanity sometimes, right? To figure out solutions for them, right? You know, to really fall in love with their problems, solve them for them. You become a partner that they want forever, you know? And yeah. I think that mentality wins usually all the time. You know, once in a while you get a customer that doesn't appreciate stuff, but not too often. You really solve their problems. You know, they don't even have to like you, which we want our customers to be friends too, but they didn't have to like you. If you're solving problems every day, they want you back. So
yeah.
I love it. So tell us about some like solutions that we would understand as, you know, maybe with a little bit of engineering and common sense. Tell us about a solution that might have separated you from your competition from you know, maybe in the first 5 years that really gave you a leg up on competitors because of how you served your customers.
Yeah. You know, if you can imagine that, let's take a refinery. Everybody kind of understands what a refinery is, so it's a good example to use. Crude oil comes in the front, and out the back goes gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, you know, methane or natural gas. And so that refineries are separating crude oil into these components. In a big refinery, you have one day of downtime. You're liable to lose something like $10 million in a day, maybe wow. more. So there are massive dollars. Now, you got how many different pieces are there of a refinery? I mean, you got pipe and you got pressure vessels and heat exchangers and pumps. And a decent sized refinery, when you add all the individual components up, it may have 30 or 40,000 different components that all have to work together to bring in crude oil and stuff out the back. So imagine you're the guy in charge of a refinery. You got 40,000 different pieces of machinery all having to work. Imagine it's like having a fleet of 40,000 cars. And if any one of those cars breaks, the entire fleet can't make money. I mean, it's a very complicated problem. So back 15 years ago, what we were saying is, man, we got to start taking all this data. Now, back then, one section, right? This 15 years ago, this is like, man, I got to do something with all this data. And it's sitting in spreadsheets and it's in pieces of paper and it's in Bob's head. Someone's got to get all this stuff and just put it into basic databases so that we can run very simple analyses on it. Nothing sexy, just get the data from A and put it in a place we can use it. And what they were doing is they were paying engineering firms by the hour to do this incredibly intensive manual process. In general, they were using what we would consider experts, people with, you know, 20, 25, 30 years of expertise in this machinery to pull this data. It was costing literally millions of dollars just to move the data because of all the manual processes. And it was very error prone because while the people who were doing it were very smart, they weren't actually good at managing data. That wasn't their skill set. People didn't know that 15 years ago. So we said, man, let's streamline this process. Yes, there's manual processes, but some of these manual processes can be done by kids fresh out of college. In fact, they're going to be a lot faster and higher quality than, you know, Ryan Sitton, the 25-year expert. And then we can also build some database tools to help us quality check this along the way. So we were able to take all this old data, move it into new systems and run very basic analyses on it for a fraction of the cost and at much, much higher quality. So you could start using the data a lot quicker. So we were in big industry, in refining, we were one of the first companies in the world that did that. Now, like today, you'd say, well, that's That's data science, that's data analytics. Everyone's getting into that business. Yeah, they are today. They weren't 17 years ago.
No. Okay, so what did your team look like back then in the first couple of years? What did your whole team look like?
So I'm trying to think. By the end of year two, we probably had something like 15 people. It was me and basically me, one administrative person, and like 13 college kids. I mean, I'd hired a lot of kids fresh out of Texas A&M. I actually did have, in fact, our longest serving employee still works here today. Her name's Malia. So she's been here. She had a little bit of experience before, but met a lot of brand new faces. And so, yeah, it's basically, and people used to even joke, oh, here comes Ryan and the kids are coming to do an engineering project for, you know, Exxon or Valero or one of these big companies.
Ryan and the kid, and you're a kid too at the time.
I was, yeah, 31 years old when I started Pinnacle.
Yeah. Yeah, so what about your wife? You didn't put her to work being a mechanical engineer just like you?
I did not go to work in mechanical engineer because someone had to do the books and we couldn't afford an accountant. So my wife, who's incredibly smart, we started up our first little QuickBooks and the very first invoice we ever set, Jennifer sent it. Ran numbers in QuickBooks, set the invoice out, basic banking stuff. She would any sort of administrative stuff that we did early on, Jennifer was kind of in charge of it. And she managed, if you will. In fact, I remember when we hired Steve Corey, who was our first full-time controller, that Jennifer was like, okay, I'm going to go retire and raise kids. Because back then, in fact, a sidebar story here, I'll tell the longer story. When we started Pinnacle, Jennifer was not working. She was stay-at-home mom. We had two kids. One, Sarah, would have been, call it 2 years old, and Luke was like 2 months old. So what happened is I'd work during the day, and I would do all my work. I'd come home, and I'd take the kids, and Jennifer would work. So one of us was working almost all the time from sun up to sundown. It's just one of us was with kids. I used to joke, you've ever heard the term dink, double income, no kids? We were double kids, no income. it was the early days were really exciting.
When you started, okay, and I was just coaching my niece and her husband on their business they started a couple of years ago. And, you know, they basically say they're breaking even. Now, these are two smart kids, too. They said, we're basically breaking even now. Okay, so you're paying yourself how much? Well, we're not paying ourselves. Okay, so right. I said, well, then you're not breaking even. You're losing money. Right. That's okay as long as you're progressing and you have a vision of paying yourself in the near future and eventually, you know, paying, you know, and making profit on top of paying yourself. It's just paying yourself, but still breaking even. Anyway, so when you looked at that back then, were you breaking even? Were you paying yourself and breaking even those first couple of years? Or were you just
We first year, we did not break even. In fact, we started June of 2006. By the end of 2006, we had not broken even because I hadn't taken a paycheck. Now, because I wasn't actually, the company was building cash, but we were draining cash. In 2007, though, we were able to take a paycheck. I think we paid ourselves $85,000 that year and the company made profit. In fact, an interesting thing, I'll tell you, Gary, when we first started Pinnacle, I put $10,000 in our first business account. I've never put any more money in since. We've never taken investors, never borrowed money. So over 17 years, that $10,000 turned into, we'll do $80 million in revenue this year.
That's awesome.
We're blessed, profitable. It's the benefit of playing the long game.
That's awesome. Yeah. You know, my business has been bootstrapped the same way. I haven't taken on any partners. I spun off many companies. So on some of the companies I spun off, I've sold a couple, killed a couple. And then nowadays we've got a couple we've taken some outside interest in, but my main business, the paving companies, still never have, right? And, you know, kind of the same thing. Started very small, a couple thousand bucks, and grew it. We'll do, you know, 100, our paving business do about 180 to 200 million in revenues for paving parking lots. And then we've got another, those are five companies. And then we got another seven to nine companies, about nine companies we'll have by the end of this year. On top of that, but those companies are smaller startups that become decent sized companies. And sometimes we'll sell some of those to private equities if we think there's a road to bigger growth and stuff. But still kind of same as you, that niche business that I started in and that I love a lot. It's hard to take money on that or think about selling the that type of business that your family and yourself are so involved in, right?
Stop. Well, I'll tell you, my plan is not to sell Pinnacle ever. And I've been blessed. Financially, we do plenty well. And in fact, the only other business I've started is a real estate business. We talk about that too, but that business will go to my family. But Pinnacle here, I'm not bachelor at this. My goal is that not in an ESOP program, but in an actual employees here will own this company. So my goal at Pinnacle is to build a perpetual business that is independent of Ryanson. That 100 years from now, someone is sitting here talking about this phenomenal, innovative company that people do wild things to help affect the world. When you think about reliability, that doesn't sound that sexy. We think about reliability of power systems and of municipal programs and of education and of individual health. I mean, reliability is all around the world. And this company could be around for hundreds of years doing things that today most of us can't even dream of. And so my goal is not to tell the company to make a lot of money. The goal is to create something that far outlives me and my family. And so that's a very different objective than most people who start business.
That's awesome. My mentality is every business I build can be sold and may be sold, right? That's not my objective ever. But I always want to build the businesses to where my leaders understand the value of those businesses on the open market. So we kind of study the open market. We understand the multiple of EBITDA at the time that year by year they might trade at. And then my leaders are kind of paid by the increased value of the businesses, whether it be through we call LTIPs or real stock. Their biggest compensation is based on that growth of value, right? And so for me, it's like, no matter what, whether I want to sell one of these businesses or never want to sell one, I want to always build them to be looked upon as really sexy to the outside to want to buy, because it's not based on Gary Rabine. It's not based on my son, who's a CEO of a bunch of these companies, or my daughter, who's the president of one of our companies, or any of our leaders. It's based on the processes. It's based on the differentiation and the services we bring. But any good leader could walk into leadership in these businesses and take them over and be very successful. And then they make a lot of money outside, of course, your overhead. And I think that's the important thing is whether you my opinion, right? Whether I ever want to sell a business or not, or any of us, in my opinion, always be building it for value, because that's what we should be growing, right? To grow customers or revenues is great, but it doesn't mean a lot if you're not growing value. And if you're growing value, whether you want to sell or not, I believe you're going the right direction, right?
Yep. How we do that, I'll share this with you, because I think I've given this advice to a number of other entrepreneurs starting their company. If you really want to play the long game, most entrepreneurs don't. They'll say that, but they're full of bull. What they really want to do is build up a company and sell it off and make a lot of money. That's, I would guess, 98% of people that start businesses, that's really what their objective is. I want to get this, build it up, sell it off, make a lot of money and whatever. But if you really want to play the long game, which I think is more fun, and I'll just share this with you, because if I had wanted to sell Pinnacle, I could have sold Pinnacle at one point, probably for between $300 and $400 million. And I don't even know what to do with a tenth of that much money. So clearly that would have been done. But if you said today, even if somebody came and said, I'll give you $1 billion for it, the answer is no, because if you gave me $1 billion, then I have $1 billion, but I wouldn't get to show up and do something. I love showing up to work here. I love doing crazy things and bold things. We don't have outside investors, don't have shareholders, so I don't have to answer to anybody except for customers and team members. And so that freedom you can't buy. And so anyway, when I tell people, if you're gonna play the long game, which I think is really fun, the way we talk about value with our team here, as you just mentioned, Gary, there are now, I own most of the company, but there are a bunch of shareholders and we do dividends every year. In fact, we do dividends every quarter. So when I now, the way I treat, the way we have set the company up is there's a board of directors and then there are shareholders, just like a publicly traded company, except they're all employees here. I report to the board of directors, even though I'm the biggest shareholder, I don't decide my own salary. Board of directors decides my salary. And this is all fairly new, but my goal, and I tell this to all the shareholders, is I think we all ought to be thinking in terms of what's the long-term ability of this company to generate dividends. I don't ever want to make a decision because I want to maximize a dividend or a distribution today. I want to make a decision to invest in something or to build something or to hire somebody or do something, engage in a project or fire a client based on my long-term ability to generate distribution. Love it. That's how we think about value, is the ability of this to generate value for shareholders on an ongoing basis.
Awesome. I think that's so important. Okay, when you think about this, okay, your board of directors, do you trust them to figure out what you're worth on an annual basis, and all your other leaders too, I'm assuming, right?
Well, the way we're set up, like any company, the what you would call in a public traded company, you call them the named officers or the listed officers. I think I can't remember what they call them in SEC filing. Four people here whose compensation is determined by the board: the chief CEO, the chief strategy officer, the chief operating officer, and the president. Those four are decided by the board. Everybody else is decided by the four of us. So we, just like in any other business. So yeah, I trust that board. In fact, I'll say this, I'm challenging that board right now. You guys got to treat me as an employee. You, the board, represent the shareholder. Even though, yes, you all work here, you got to think of me as your employee. Am I, as the CEO, doing what's in the long-term interest of your shareholders? If not, you got to challenge me on that. How do you reward my performance of this? So the reason is, it's easy for us to think this way now, because everyone just trusts Ryan, he's run the place forever. But I assume another 5 years, there's going to be somebody else going to be the CEO. And how will we have the maturity in our board to compensate our leaders then to build this, you know, company that will last, 100 years.
By the way, that's awesome.
You didn't ask about this, but I'll say it. If you look, how many companies are built, privately owned, that last 100 years and stay privately owned? The ratio, Gary, is insanely small. It's like 1 in 100,000. It never happens. And the ones where it does happen, they're almost always tied to a fairly big asset. Like, you know, say you're in the oil business and, you know, dad started the oil company, or granddad started the oil company, bought up all of these minerals and all this production, started building it. And then the son and the grandson runs it. In terms of being a services company or a people-based company, I mean, it's exceptionally rare. So one of the things I'm excited about is to be 48 today. I'm 88 years old in 40 years. And no, man, we built something that will way outlast me, my kids, whatever. Like this, we built something that's going to be there for a long time.
I love it. It's awesome. And a lot, like you said, not a lot of people have that as their goal. I mean, most people want to grow, want to make a lot of money, then they want to sell for a lot of money, right?
Yes.
And I think that's the people that actually, have a formula to grow and to exceed expectations of a normal business. Because more normal businesses, small businesses start up, they're more often to either, die when that owner gets sick of it, or is too old to run anymore, or sell, in my industry, sell your equipment at the auction and that's it. You know, that's more likely than moving on to be a generational company or a company that could be sold on a great multiple of EBITDA, in the open market. But like you're saying, to last 100 years as a private company, yeah, it doesn't happen. Doesn't happen very often at all. Yeah. So that's a pretty cool goal. And so there's all different ways to transfer stock and all that and keep that alive, whether it be ESOPs. I have friends of mine that run an ESOP company today. I own a golf club, and all the executives are members of this golf club. We got one of the best businesses I know in the Midwest. They're a big steel company. Okay. Started with the family about 80 years ago, and it's been an ESOP now for about probably 30 years now. And this company probably is $700 or $800 million company, and they're an amazing company. People love being there, love working there, and most people have retired. They've been there for more than 20 years. Retired millions of dollars. Whether they're and most of these people are labor in the shop, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, pretty cool. It's really cool to watch this company continue to thrive, because they've got, employee ownership that cares a lot, employee leadership that acts like the original founders acted years ago, very innovatively, right? Always looking for the next best thing to kick their competition's butts. So again, and that business is about 80, 85. You look him up when you get a chance. Scott Forge. I'm supposed to do an interview with the CEO, John. He's a great guy. He's been the CEO for probably 20 years now, looking to retire in the near future. But I think he's ready to retire in the near future. I shouldn't say he's looking to, but anyway, great guy. And that business is thriving today. And what I believe has to happen, and you're the type of person that can inspire this, is that innovative mind, the entrepreneurial mind, to continue. Because when we see, big companies grow and then other private equities buy into it, or they go public or whatever, the bureaucracy begins. And as you know, being a part of the government in Texas, as you were, me looking at, watching government a lot over the last 20 years, biggest problem we have is we have no innovation in government. We don't have people that have built anything in government. It's a big political bureaucracy, of course, and there's not a lot of creativity, right, to keep government fresh. Because you have unions that come in the middle, lobbyists and all these crazy, and then people that have never built anything, they're at the top of the food chain, right? So I look at business very, very much the same. If I grow out of my business and I sell out of my business, say some private equities group that just wants to scale it now to be much, much bigger, a bureaucracy, comes into play and the innovation pretty much stops. You're hiring these Ivy League guys and gals out of school, never built anything. You've got people coming in from the PE group to operate, and they're hiring hired guns. And unfortunately, as we know, you look, and I was talking to the CEO today of Best Buy, who's a good friend of mine.
Nice.
And we were talking about the same exact thing. As we're trying to build an organization for small businesses across the country, the biggest thing we see is big corporate America, instead of being innovative, relies on lobbyists and big government to kiss their butts and to help create their long-term success today, right? Compared to the innovators they once were at Best Buy, Home Depot. Bernie Marcus is a friend of mine. Bernie Marcus is one of the greatest innovators of our time. And Home Depot, a great company that is today, much more bureaucratic than it ever was, is different than that innovative company that they were when Bernie was at the helm for the first 40 years, right? So again, the challenge is for that 100 years of private sector is how you, what processes you put in play to make sure your leaders stay innovative, they stay risk, they invite risk and they don't become risk averse, right?
Right.
When you think about that, right? How do you build your culture so you make sure that stays in place beyond you, right?
Well, I'll share with you that there's a constant battle. In other words, the world celebrates status. And I'm going to get real philosophical, but this is whether you're talking government, you're talking healthcare, you're talking education, you're talking small business, the world celebrates status. And social media has exacerbated that so badly. Unfortunately, kids are growing up, hey, and they're looking on Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram, and their picture of success is 100% tied to status. The problem with status is based on everything we did in the past. It's not based on what we're doing in the future. And so I don't care what walk of life you're in today, but we are being sort of preached to, if you will. Just figure out a way to find your status in the way the world is today. And so the notion of going out and disrupting for the sake of creating something new and valuable and impactful, it is very hard to get through there. So why I say that is, yes, in our business, as you just articulated, Gary, it's a constant battle. I'll say, we're trying to figure out, how do I create status? Because that's language everybody's. Imagine 10 years from now, somebody shows up to work here and I've never met them. And even people who've been here a long time don't get a chance to meet. They show up and they're thinking in the terms of status, because that's what the world does. When they show up at our company, status is tied to creating things that are innovative and disruptive and taking us forward. That it's hard to do. Literally today, I sent an email to some of my key leadership team members about restructuring a small piece of our company and pulling a few key minds together whose job it is to drive innovation across a bigger group of employees, literally today. So, and I could, if we're having this conversation in 6 months, I'll be doing something else. So trying to figure out the structures, the systems, the processes that drive, that identify, that formalize, that even celebrate disruptive things, that create budgets for that, if you will. So it's kind of like, it's almost counterintuitive. How do you create a system to disrupt systems? But that's what we're doing. And you're exactly right when you said it, Gary. It's a big part of what I spend my time doing.
Yeah. So yes. And so, and what we've done so far, Ryan, is I believe in moonshots. I believe in throwing a moonshot out there, understanding your customers' challenges and the things they need, the problems they need to be fixed, right? And then come up with some aspirational moonshots that you can actually look out to and say, when we do this, right? Like finishing concrete, as I was talking earlier about, when you can finish the longest lasting concrete in the world to look like beautiful conventional concrete, I'm confident that market goes from half of 1% in the country to 20-30% of all pavements, right? That was an aspirational moonshot I've had for years, and we figured it out. And I believe that, you know, for me and our team, my leaders, to continue to throw moonshots out there on things, problems they're going to solve for our customers tomorrow, that will take us to a whole nother world in our industry, our business, and actually, you know, change the industry that we thrive in.
So my question is to you then, Gary, and this is something that I'm dealing right now. It's easy for guys like you and I, Gary. We're entrepreneurs. We love risk, right? We thrive on risk. And in fact, people around us, almost by nature, if they like being around us, they've at least got to tolerate that, if not get some right out of that too. The hard part is how to extend this. I'm with you on moonshots. In fact, if we had more time and really want to give the geekiness of reliability, over the last, quick sidebar, the last 5 years, we've spent, give on, no outside investors, no debt, spent $20 million of our own money building a new software package that's a moonshot. It's going to redefine the way reliability is done in big industry all over the world. Kind of thing where, you know, if you're sitting here another 5 years, 10 years, you'll hear the biggest companies in the world all use Pinnacle's program Newton to drive reliability. It'll be a game changer. That's a moonshot. Man, that's a bold call to say, we're going to spend $20 million? I mean, that's like over the next 5 years, that's half of our cash flow is going on this one software product. How do you get, it's easy for you and me to do that, relatively speaking. And it's even easy for people around us to do that, knowing that you and I are wired that way. How do you instill that in your organization so that even if you and I are not there, that next group of people will do that? That's what we're working on. I'm trying to figure out how to, and we're getting there. I've got a group and I've got a team that will do that, but that's the big thing I'm trying to get to, is how to, that they don't need me to authorize those moonshots. It's almost expected.
Yeah, it's tough, right? Because they're good people are thinking of it as, this is Ryan's money. I don't want to take too much risk with Ryan's money, where Ryan could say, you know, no bullshit. I'm taking risks. This is my money. This is our money. And we're going to solve these customers' problems. And if we do a great job with it, we're going to win. And the industry is going to win. But it's easier for you or I to do that, knowing it's kind of mostly, you know, our investment or our loss when we lose. Where you're right to take that on to take to the next generation of leaders and say, okay, this is your baby. You need to take risk. How do you build that into the culture of the company? That's the challenge.
And I like
you're kind of doing it. If you said you're building a team of people that are constantly about innovating and taking it to another world, that'll help. But then to get those leaders to understand how much risk they can take. Because if, when they lose, you know, do they crash and burn, or they get up fast and go forward and say, Ryan, you know, we know the mistakes we made and now we're going to fix them, and we're going to make sure that investment and that loss turns into a big win in the future. Right.
Yep.
So that's okay. So tell me about the energy world. We've got, in our state of Illinois, we've got, in my opinion, really dumbass, leaders in our government that are eliminating, our nuclear energy, eliminating the best, the cleanest coal burning plant in the country, maybe in the world, is going to be eliminated in our state of Illinois in the next few years. Okay.
Yeah.
These it's continue to do everything they can to promote solar and wind as it's, you know, the only way for the future. While we're going to go from the least cost, one of the least cost providers of energy 5 years ago, we'll be like California in the next 10 years. Okay. As we eliminate all our you know, good our strong energy in solar and nuclear and coal and actually natural gas also. And so again, when I watch what's going on here and I see, you know, smart states doing what's right, you know, basically leveraging all forms of energy, whether it be solar, wind, but not picking winners and losers in government like we are here in Illinois.
Yeah.
What do you see for the future? And, you know, what are you seeing in Texas and the country? And tell me your feeling on that.
Sure. Well, as you probably know, and I imagine a lot of your listeners do know this, but they may not get the extent of it. if you were to add up all the energy that is produced in the United States today, and I'm talking about, you know, oil that's converted into gasoline, and, you know, oil is mostly used for transportation. Natural gas is tied to the ground, is used predominantly for power generation and then, you know, home heating. And then you've got, you know, a lot of your electricity capacity from coal, as you mentioned. But you, between coal and natural gas and oil, those still make up something like 85% of the nation's energy portfolio. The other 15% is nuclear, hydroelectric, some renewables. And renewables are growing as a percentage faster than any of the others, but they're not even, capturing all of the growth that is needed in energy. So any losses, for example, in coal are more than made up for by growth in like things like natural gas today. I say all that to say, right now today, Texas produces 25% of the nation's energy. So just, you know, to give a ballpark number out there, the rest of the country runs on Texas energy, you know, 25% of it. So we love the fact that you guys are shutting down your energy there because you're all going to come buy it from us. Now, joking aside, I'll get real philosophical for you with you here for a second. Let's talk a little sort of, you know, big, broad-scale geopolitics. If you look at what has caused, and you can look at a lot of historians and sort of anthropologists and political science majors who will sort of theorize about economists, for example, who have theorized about what really did cause the United States to become this global economic power. Certainly World War II was arguably the biggest sort of single event, right? Really decimated Europe. And we were relatively unaffected compared to Europe, right? Where like UK was just destroyed. So we had this basis of to build on. But we had a combination of unparalleled work ethic in the United States. U.S. had this, like, we are just can-do-it people, and we had an abundance of natural resources. You put those two things together, and that is what caused the United States. Most, like I said, economists, political science, that's what they all agree on. Let's look today at where we position today, and over the next, say, 20 years, how will we position? Yes, we have abundance of natural resources, but we're choosing not to leverage them. At the same time that China is leveraging their natural resources at epic proportion, even other people's natural resources at epic proportion. So we're going to lose the advantage. Where does that abundance of natural resources play out in an economic way? It's affordability of basic costs. Wood, paper, bricks, concrete, as you know about, energy costs, plastics. When you have the cheapest raw commodity cost, that gives your economy a big advantage. The United States has had the cheapest on balance commodities for the last 50 years, and we're losing that today. That's number one. Two, unfortunately, it was accelerated by COVID. You know, you got a lot of people preaching to people you shouldn't have to work that hard. You don't need to innovate. You know, you can work from home. Same time, people in, you know, other countries like India and China, they're like, dude, I will work 12 hours a day to make the needle move. So when you see portions of our country saying, yeah, we're going to lean into being this sort of work from home state and sort of this, man, you don't really need to come, just come when it's convenient. And we're going to make sure you get a minimum wage, whether or not you're working. And we're going to make sure we don't really leverage our natural resources the right way. We are losing both of the big advantages that got the United States to where we are economically. So,
labor wise, we don't need to do that stuff. You know, we're going to be technology driven. Labor's bad. Skilled trades. Oh, come on, really? No,
exactly.
Those are the things we got to get back to. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, I go back to what you're seeing in Illinois. And as you watch this play out, and you don't even have to go that far. Look at the difference between California and Texas, the two biggest economies in terms of states in the union. I think California, if was its own country, it'd be like the eighth largest economy in the world. If Texas was its own, it'd be the 10th. And man, Texas economy is growing at a much bigger pace. You have much better balance in terms of the affordability of lifestyle compared to income balance. I mean, there's so many things that show that the Texas model is working far superior to the California model. And yes, the Californians lean into it. They're like, yeah, we think the Texans are just lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, so I say all that, say you talk about energy. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. The optimist in me believes that when it really comes down to it, while voters will vote for some crazy stuff sometimes, because politicians will say some stuff that really sounds good, that's easy to confuse, kind of in mass by saying things that sound good, but they really don't work well. When the average voter is going home and feel they're like, dude, I'm paying $7 a gallon for gasoline. I don't really care what political party you are, but this sucks.
Yeah.
That's when I think we're going to start seeing a little bit shift. I'm not saying we should not advance renewable. Just let the market work it out. Musk and Tesla, right? He created a product people want. They were at the time willing to pay more for it. Teslas have actually, those cars are very efficient energy cars. They're expensive to buy. Some would argue they're not as really nice a car from a luxury perspective. But fact is, they on a free market basis created a car that's a good product. Sure. Now, some would argue if the subsidies that are in place weren't in place, whether Tesla would have done as well as it did. And I think most people would say it wouldn't have. The point is, let the market work that out. We don't need to diminish renewables.
100%.
I think that I hope that some practicality will come back into our energy strategies over the next couple of years as people realize this just ain't working.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I believe that, let the market work it out, as you said. You know, the innovation happens when small businesses have to innovate to succeed and get the leg up, right, on big business. When government gets involved, small businesses are de-incentivized because they're not going to get the $100 million that Solyndra got, or
right.
Whatever. So,
right.
So on that subject, think about as a leader, do you share with your team and do you talk about politics? Do you talk about religion? Do you talk about these things in your business, around your business? Because, in Illinois, I actually do still, and there's not many people in my position in business in Illinois that will speak about religion in front of their teammates or politics. Well, I believe that my opinion is the only way you know somebody is and you share your experiences with people. Who are you? I don't have to agree with you on either one of those two things. But I like to know who I am, and if you want to share who you are, great, right? That's how we get to know each other better, by sharing experiences. Tell me what you think of when you think of those two subjects as a business leader.
Yeah, in fact, my stance is I'll share anything. There's some companies out there that are leaning hard into this sort of transparency thing. Everything we do at the company is going to share with everyone. I don't think that makes a lot of sense, but I am very transparent. Any employee here anytime can ask me any question. Every employee here knows how much money I make. They all know that I'm a Christian. They know that I'm a conservative Republican. And I don't demand that they believe the same things I believe. I do demand that they respect them, and I'll respect theirs as well. We're going to have respectful dialogue about these things. I don't talk about them. If there's times where I am, say, presenting to the entire company, I as the CEO to the entire company, I don't usually weave it in there because we got business things to talk about. But if I'm sitting at a lunch where we're all participating in the lunch, absolutely. And you know what's funny is, Gary, we'll be sitting at lunch sometimes. And you obviously been around politics a lot too. It's interesting to me. I've got really personal insights. For example, Ted Cruz, personal friend. I've hung around Ted a lot. And one thing that I get disappointed, Ted, when you get him, like if we were just sitting around talking, Ted is one of the funniest human beings you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because if you see Ted on the screen, it comes across, I would say this if he was like, it comes across as kind of like political nerd, just sort of hardcore. You don't get this very affable, like funny guy. And so I like to share that with people, that these are real people too. Yeah. And yet I can sense when I bring this up with people, like, my friend Ted Cruz, they're like,
Ted Cruz, I don't like Ted Cruz.
Like, don't you want to know? Like, I actually know these people. Let's chat about this. Don't you have the insight?
Yeah.
Yes, dear.
So I've decided I'm going to be supporting DeSantis in the presidential race. And I've been a Trump guy since the beginning. But I become a citizen, 7-month citizen in Florida, and I see all the great things he's doing to move people like me to his state, as you guys have been in Texas for a long time. I had a meeting with him yesterday for about an hour with a couple of friends, and he was awesome. And the other two friends of mine that I brought in, along with my girlfriend, they were all bought in on DeSantis. But getting to talk to him, pretty personally, you could see the passion he has to serve. You could see that he's smart as can be. He's not an arrogant guy like people want to say he is. People say a lot of things about him. He's a really good guy, intelligent as can be, and he's the right guy. But again, if you don't share those experiences with people to say, wait a minute, a person has to look like they do because they have that sound bite they have to give, or that 2 or 3 minute speech or whatever it is. But in person, who are they, right? And if you could be a witness to that, that's a great thing. And Ted Cruz, I also a great guy. I've only met him a couple times briefly, but I've heard great things about him. there's actually a poker and a poker cigar fundraiser with Ted Cruz coming up here a week or two. And I was invited to. I think I'm gone or out of town or something, but I was like, that'd be pretty cool to play poker with him and smoke a cigar with him and hang out. It's, you know, you really get to know people when they share their personal experiences.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so when you think of networking, you know, your business to get as big as it is, you had to network with other businesses, other people in your industry to understand it better, outside your industry to understand how your friends grew their businesses, right? Tell me about what networks you get involved in. Anything you looked upon and say, gosh, if there's one network of people, of leaders that have helped me get to where I've gotten, is there any out there that you can think of?
Man, it's a good question, and I challenge you to stump me, and that might be a stumper. But I'll say it this way. There's no one, this network, this org. I was in Vistage for a while. Another version was called Tech, I think, TEC. Strategic Coach program up in Canada. Sure. Guy, Dan Sullivan, you don't have to do that one. I've been a part of that for a while. All good. I wouldn't say there was one specific network that proved to be, you know, demonstrably more powerful or influential. Instead, I would just say it this way. I sort of approach life, and I think a lot of what I would consider to be really good entrepreneurs do this. Any interaction, doesn't even have to be with an entrepreneur. Could be with a business leader, could be with a doctor, could be with a educator, you know, could whoever. I always feel like I can learn something from anybody. You know, everybody's got some unique perspective on the world. That means that I'm always going to learn something that's really valuable or impactful in my business. And sometimes you learn something and you need to flush it. You're like, okay, I just learned something that really wasn't very useful. But the point is, go in and say, man, tell me about you. Tell me about how you see the world and what you're doing in your life. As I said, I wouldn't say there's any one specific network. It's more just I wouldn't even use the word networking. It's just how I approach meeting people and getting advice from people, getting input. People really do, if you really invest and you really want to learn about them and what they do and why they do it and how they think about things, you can get an amazing amount of education.
Just in our conversation, I can see you're a guy that likes to share experiences. And when you do that, when you open yourself up to share your experiences, I think good people do the same thing back. And therefore you forge a relationship for the future where you can call on them, right? Because they know you're going to be honest with them and share your experiences. They're going to be the same way with you. I think that's the key to success, in my opinion, is, you know, building relationships of trust, right? Customers, friends, network, and, you know, people in your network, as leaders. And when you do that well, and I can see you do that well, it's just a natural thing, right? I mean, when you look at, when you think about your future leaders, how do you identify? I mean, I would say this, what core values do you think of as the most important core values that you and your team need to uphold so that you're constantly creating the right leaders in the future in your business?
Well, we actually are very explicit about this. At Pinnacle, our values are impact, excellence, and growth. Everything we do.
Wait, just three things. That's it.
That's those three things.
I love it.
You're wired at Pinnacle so that everything you do matters, makes an impact. You're always striving to do it with excellence, knowing you're never going to get to perfect, but you're always striving to and find new shades of perfect or new shades of excellence and growing. We grow all the time. New ideas, new methods, innovation, your personal growth, all that. So those are our three things. We measure everything we do from a qualitative or a value perspective against those three things.
I love you. And if you read any books on values, core values for an organization to create great culture, five should be the maximum. And boy, if you can do it in two or three, even better. So you can cover about everything in those three things. So that's impact, excellence, and growth is awesome. When you guys look at your, you know, we look at everything at 80-20 kind of thing, right? When you look at, you know, 20% in my industry and almost every business I have, I think in every business I have, less than 20% of my customers deliver over 80% of the impact of profits and success in my businesses. And so therefore, on an annual basis, we're kind of reevaluating that the top 20% or less and saying, how do we grow those to be more like 30-40%, right? And no matter what you do, it seems like every time you evaluate it, that top 20% of your customers deliver 80% of your value. When you look at your teammates, right? I mean, we've got great people across the board in our businesses. We've got very few that we wouldn't rehire. Okay, and out of our, we've got something similar about 550 teammates on our teams. So when you think about that, but you still, if you look at it, you probably have 20% or less of your teammates that you couldn't get away without. They're the perfect person that drives your business. And you might have 80% that are maybe replaceable, right? When you think about customers, who are your niche 20% that you, if you could grow your business constantly after them, you'd focus on them more and to have abundant success.
So who are they specifically? Is that what your question is?
Yeah. What markets are they? Is it the chemical plants? Is it what is it?
Good question, and I'll try to answer this succinctly. It's a little bit nuanced. Right now, we do business with nominally 100 customers. And those 100 customers, there may even be a couple or three of those 100 that are actually the same company, but they're different facilities within that company.
Yeah.
And what is interesting is if you said, yes, there are some, we have a couple of facilities where we make a big chunk of our profit. They're more profitable. However, we're doing relatively sort of traditional kind of basic services. Others that are really pretty small, not that profitable, but we're innovating at that site in a big way, right? So it's very nuanced. In fact, you ask a good question here, Gary, because right now we're going through a transition at Pinnacle. We're disrupting ourselves. Our company 2 years from now is going to look drastically different than what it looked like 3 years ago. And I am actually, if you said, Ryan, you're spending your time on that customer? Well, that's a tiny customer. Literally, you got customers that do 10 times as much profit as that little guy. Yeah. But that's the one where we're creating the things, we're creating the systems, we're demonstrating our solutions that will they'll revitalize the way, or change the way we're doing our whole business. So it's nuanced beyond just profit. Or if you said we're the ones that are full, it's a few, and they are. I'll tell you, one is a lumber mill. There's a lot of work at a specific lumber mill right now that is allowing us to change the whole game of reliability in revolutionary ways. A tiny little refinery that you have never heard of before. It's not an Exxon or a Valero or a Chevron. We do business with all the majors out there, but it's these guys are the ones that are moving the needle for us. And those customers know it. I share it with them very candidly. They know, why is the CEO of this company showing up here? Because, man, this is the stuff that's going to change the world. And it's happening at your site.
I love it. We have a technology, a couple of things. I'm somebody I want you to meet, a good friend of mine that's built a few technology companies, and the one he's on right now, he's growing rapidly. It's I don't know if it's $1 billion value or more. It's big already, and he's done a couple other ones before this. Anyway, he's in your space, and he's doing something with smart grid metering and stuff. So it allows customers to understand how much energy they're using, how they can adjust it, where they can learn to be more efficient, and all that kind of stuff. Right? I'll get you his name, but I feel like he could be a good contact for you just to pick his brain. He's a spectacular person first and foremost. And then he just very innovative guy. And I was talking to him just recently because we have a technology company where we just took on a couple of venture partners that are strategic, more than the cash, are strategic to grow the business. And so I had him counsel me on what I should be looking at about, you know, with these partners. But anyway, this back to what we're doing, and there may be a way to help in your industry. So we fly properties with drones all over the world now, and we use artificial intelligence to assess the condition of pavements, roofs, where we're very good in both of those. We're building the engineering now for facades, and then we'll be doing lighting, environmental, and all that for big distribution centers and large property owners. Some of your customers would be perfect fits to use that for, but If you have information and data you could gather from building AI to fly those same properties that we're flying, or your properties, right? We should connect later on. Maybe connect you or your team with our leaders, because I feel like there's something there that we could work together on to help you in your industry, as well as help us learn more about that too, for pavements and stuff that we do, right? So it's called Site. If you look it up, it's called Site Technology, SITE. The world's biggest industrial owners are looking at this as the best technology they've seen for decades. site technologies. So look it up when you can. If you think there's a fit there, we should get together and talk about that. But basically, we're changing our industry. Before we did this, we had boots on the ground all over the country, and I'd pay my engineers to fly across the country to assess pavements for my customers. You know, big million square foot pavements. Today, we do that with drones. It costs about 10% of what it used to cost, and you get it done in about 2% of the time it took before. So it might take in a month and a half before. It takes hours or a day at the most, right, to do the same job with you know, flying these properties. So anyway, it's pretty cool.
And if there's cool.
Something, let me know. A couple more things, and Chris, I want you to go over some stuff. You know what we do, Ryan, is I like Chris to go over kind of little nuggets he picked up and things that he learned that we want to highlight. Chris, any quick questions, Chris, you want to go right to what your nuggets are that you picked up on with Ryan, the awesome entrepreneur.
Ryan, thank you so much for your time, man. This was inspiring. You're awesome. I can listen to you talk all day. I have like 30 questions that I wish we had time for.
Well, thank you. That's nice of you to say.
Really, really loved it, man. So, you know, you're short on time, so I'll just run through these. Your only limitation is your drive. Always be figuring out a way to do the job better. Look out for your customer first. The long game is more fun. I love your perspective on turning Pinnacle into not just a company for your family, but for, it sounds like, the community and the world at whole, like into perpetuity. We've had, you know, a lot of very successful guests on this show. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say something like that. That's really special. I love your perspective. To try and figure out how to tie status to innovation rather than money is a very worthwhile pursuit. Where can our audience find out more about you?
Well, I'm not hard to find. You can go to our website at Pinnacle, which is the main business we talked about today. That's just pinnaclereliability.com. I've got a website. It's a lot of data now, ryansitton.com. It's been up for a while, and you can find information there. I actually wrote a book called Crucial Decisions. It's how we use data to make decisions and how we quantify our decisions and test the decisions that we make. Anyway, that's on Amazon. You can track that down. That's a lot of sort of my insights on things. So
Crucial Decisions.
Yeah. Let's see, you can Google me. I'm not hard to find. We've been serving public office for 6 years. There's plenty of stuff out there. A lot of it's pretty entertaining too. Some of it's true.
So I like a lot of stuff here too. I had a lot of fun with Ryan. Hey, Ryan, the status is past, really. I love that because it's so true. Hey, what you have, what you drive, what you got, right? All that's the past. You know, what creates the aspiration to go forward and solve problems? I mean, that's what we need to ask ourselves. And then your values. I think you're one of the only ones that had, you know, three core values: impact, excellence, and growth. If you can do those three things on a consistent basis, success is going to happen. Good culture is going to be built, in my opinion. So really, really good stuff. I really appreciate you being on, man. You're awesome. I like all the hand gestures, man. You're into it. You're a guy that shares well and passionately. So that's something we always enjoy on the show. So thanks so much for your time. And I'm also in Dallas once in a while. One of my companies is called Pipeview America. And my CEO, my partner and CEO is down there. Another great guy. So how far are you from Dallas?
4 hours. I get to Dallas periodically, so it may happen either at the same time. But if you're down there, ping me and let me know. I'll see if there's makes sense to go up.
We're going
to
be growing south in San Antonio and Austin as well and Houston eventually. So we got to get together. All right. Well, great media. Thanks for your time. Until next time, thanks for being here. I'm Ditch Digger CEO.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at ditchdiggerceo.
Paper routes, mowing lawns, careless hands. had six kids to raise. Factory and night labor earned my day. Learn by example, not the words you say. Watch them as they left.